From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. London's Haunted Theaterland. In all, there are about 20 haunted theaters in London's Theaterland. Most of the buildings where psychic happenings took place have been demolished. Nevertheless, their ghosts live in the folklore of the London Theater. Adelphi Theater Strand. The Adelphi is a district south of London's famous Strand, and it derived its name from Adelphoi, Greek for brothers, because its development was due to Robert Adam and his brothers, James and William. Originally, there was a theater here called the Sans Pareil, which opened on November 27, 1806, but it was given its present name in 1819. This playhouse had a checkered career, yet it won fame with the presentation of the Adelphi melodramas of Madame Celeste and Ben Webster of 1844 and Gatti from 1879. The profits from the plays allowed the theater to be rebuilt in 1858. A much-loved Victorian actor, William Terrace, father of actress Aline Terrace, and father-in-law to the late actor Sir Seymour Hicks, was the idol at the Adelphi for many years. The theater world was shocked when William Terrace was stabbed to death by a mad actor, Richard Archer Prince, over an imaginary grievance on December 16, 1897. Thereafter, the theater was considered haunted by Terrace's ghost. One recorded sighting dates back to 1928. The psychic investigator Joseph Braddock left a note on this ghost in 1956. A man, who at the time had never heard of the murder, was walking in the narrow, shadowy alley alongside the Adelphi Theater. Suddenly he stared hard because he had seen a handsome, old-fashioned figure pass him oddly dressed, with a flowing tie and a sombrero hat. The man was surprised and turned round to have another look, but the alley was empty and there had not been time for any living person to disappear. The man, who had never believed in ghosts when told the facts of the murder, became convinced that he had seen the ghost of Terrace, particularly as the apparition must have vanished near the door through which the actor had so often entered the theater, the last time to die. Some years afterward, the Sunday Dispatch, dated January 15, 1956, ran the story that in November 1955, the ghost of William Terrace had been seen in Covent Garden's underground station by several members of the station staff. A four-page report was sent to the London Transport Executive Divisional Headquarters concerning the statuesque figure of a man wearing a gray suit, old-fashioned collar, and white gloves. Foreman collector Jack Hayden, one of those who saw this tall, distinguished-looking specter more than once, eventually rang headquarters at Leicester Square. "We have a ghost here," he said. Foreman Eric Davis, spiritualist, was sent down and held a seance in the anteroom. Davis said, "I got the name T.E.R. Something and a murder nearby." That evening, somebody suggested Terrace. Pictures of the actor were found. They resembled a psychic sketch made by Davy. "That's him," Hayden said. The ghost was seen again in 1962 by theater staff. Yet for over 70 years, the theater has been the scene of strange lights, odd rapping noises and tappings which all emanate from the dressing rooms used by Terrace. These unexplained noises have puzzled many actors and actresses. Why should they occur? Then one old bit part actor, Charles Faversham, remembered. "I was a scene shifter when old Terrace was murdered in Maiden Lane by Prince, and I saw them carry his bleeding body in. I can see it now. His leading lady, Jessie Millward, cradled him in her arms, and he died there 20 minutes later. Now every time he went out, he had the habit of tapping a couple of times with his stick on the door of Miss Millward's dressing room, just to let her know he was away. June, the well-known musical comedy actress, experienced the tappings in March 1928. A chaise lounge was also levitated in her dressing room, and she saw for some seconds a greenish light hovering in front of the mirror. Her sightings of the manifestations were to be unique, however, for she felt something grip her forearm, and later painful wheels appealed on the arms. June's dresser, Ethel Rowland, also heard the tappings. No psychic happenings are recorded, it seems, regarding William Terrace's murderer. Prince was found guilty but insane and spent the rest of his life in Broadmoor, an institution for the criminally insane, where he died in 1937, aged 71. Ivor Novello, who passed away in 1951, composer of Keep the Home Fires Burning and author-composer of the plays Glamorous Night and King's Rhapsody, among other pieces, it's thought to haunt the Adelphi, where he had many successes. That is, his wraith is there when it's not haunting the Palace Theatre and Cambridge Circus, where he was seen in 1973 and 1974 by actor Peter Wingard, then starring in The King and I. Mr. Wingard reported that the ghost used to steal things. No one really knows how many ghosts haunt the Adelphi, or whether or not it is one ghost masquerading as three. Terrace, Novello, and maybe even Charles Keene, who died in 1868. Not all the psychic phenomena here are the same. Noises, lights, and ghostly emanations do not always coincide. All that one theater electrician saw, for instance, late one night, was a phantom in a gray suit silently walking through a whole row of seats, tipping them up as he went, then disappeared near the wall, marked exit. Coliseum Theater, St. Martin's Lane. Named after the famous Colosseum in Rome, the Colosseum had only been haunted, it seems, by one ghost, along with a host of young soldiers. One subaltern, a junior officer, in 1918 made a last visit to see the high-kicking chorus of the Colosseum before embarking for the Western Front. That night, the subaltern led his men towards the enemy lines, October 3, 1918. His ghost was seen in the theater. The soldier was killed and his uniformed remains recognized. But even as his mortal body lay dead in the Flanders mud at the Colosseum Theater in London, his ghost slowly made its way down the rows of seats of the dress circle. Only minutes before the house lights dim, the ghost took his seat 2 rows from the front. During the years between the 2 world wars, the ghost of the khaki-clad soldier was seen mostly in the auditorium, Emma Martin remembers. I was sitting in the dress circle with my father, Harry Martin, the impresario. It must have been around the 19th of October, as I remember the paper saying that the Germans had been driven back from Zeebrugg and Bruges. Just as the lights in the theater were dimmed, this soldier hurried down the aisle and sat 2 rows in front of us in the last available seat. I recall seeing his head being silhouetted against the stage lights. Then I was taken up by the action on stage, and when I looked again, he had gone. In the meantime, of course, no one had passed us. Father said that the soldier's flashes or insignia were of a cavalry regiment. There are no recent sightings of the Revenant. Collins Music Hall, Islington Green. This music hall was demolished several years ago following a devastating fire. Memories of its ghost, however, remain with such performers as Mary Lloyd, Little Titch, and Harry Randall. The specter, folks say, was that of an Irishman called Vag, who toured the vaudeville theaters of Britain as Sam Collins, the singing chimney sweep. This ghost had haunted the theater for a number of years before its final curtain fell in 1963, and it materialized usually around 9 p.m. in the manager's office. Before and during the manifestation, doors would slam shut of their own accord, even when they had been jammed open with pieces of metal. Small desk items like paper clips, a cigarette lighter, and so on would be levitated, At least this is what the theater's proprietor, Lou Lake, attested to in 1948. Once someone accepted a challenge to sleep overnight on the couch in the manager's office. But the man fled when he felt an icy phantom grasp on his neck. Archie Bowles, who was a cleaner at the theater for a number of years, said, "More than once I was tidying out the governor's office when a knock would come to the door and a terrible rattling of the doorknob. There was never anyone there when I answered. The knock always seemed to coincide with the interval during the second performance." This theater was also said to be haunted by the ghost of Dan Leno. The Wraith would turn up at rehearsals, occupying the same seat in the stalls, and indulge in the mortal habit Leno had of snapping his fingers during a bad performance. Testimony of this was left by Chris Rollins, who was stage manager at the Collins for 40 years. Grand Theatre, Fulham. The Grand Theatre at Fulham stood at Putney Bridge Approach so near to the River Thames that the stalls were underwater every time the river overflowed. The theatre was built by the former business manager of the spookless Criterion Theatre, Alex F. Henderson, who died in 1933 and was opened on August 23, 1897 with a production of The Geisha. Once 2,239 people could watch a show at any one time, and it gave resounding welcomes to such favorites as Charles Warner, John Hare, Charles Wyndham, and the legendary Sarah Bernhardt. According to an old actress who now lives in one of the retired thespian's homes, the theater was haunted by a Miss East Robertson, who once during a performance of A Woman's Pluck caused a sensation by staring as a lady pugilist. Miss Robinson's ghost appeared here apparently in the 1920s and was remembered by the actress Violet Van Brugge as being draped in furs. A relative of East Robertson, John M. East, an actor-manager who managed the theater from 1892 to 1904, was said to haunt the Lyric at Hammersmith. The ghost was audible, complaining about the drudgery of the people who once lived here and whom in life he had attempted to entertain. Renamed the Fulham Theatre in 1906, the playhouse was demolished in 1958. Haymarket Theatre, West End. Built on the site of John Potter's Little Theatre in the Hay of 1720, which eventually became London's third Theatre Royal, the present Haymarket Theatre, built by John Nash, opened its doors in 1821. Its ghost is said to be that of John Baldwin Buckstone, an old actor-manager who was here from 1853 to 1879, who died of a broken heart during his tenancy of the theater. He is hardly ever seen, only heard. According to eyewitnesses, the door of his old dressing room opens, and footsteps cross the floor to a cupboard, then recede, and the door again closes. Mrs. Stuart Watson, the chairman and managing director of the theater, has often seen Buckstone. He is not a misty figure, and you can't see through him. He looks real flesh and blood. Actor Stringer Davis and his wife, actress Margaret Rutherford, shared a psychic experience at the Haymarket Theatre. Once during a railway strike, Margaret Rutherford reported to startled newsmen she and Stringer camped out overnight at the Haymarket when they were appearing in the School for Scandal. Their dressing room had a bricked-up door that used to give access to the stage. Next to it was the costume wardrobe, where Margaret also stored drinks for her guests. On this particular night, Miss Rutherford said, she had a most vivid dream. I had gone to the cupboard in my dream, the action which was very, very real to me, and I couldn't get the door shut because of the voluminous of my dress. Amid them I saw a man's hairy leg and caught a glimpse of his face. Without a doubt it was the face of John Buckstone. I remember once seeing a portrait of him, but never associated him with a Haymarket. She awoke with a sense of elation and told Stringer Davis of her dream. He said that, as Margaret had called out and roused him in his sleep, he heard the cupboard door creak and the bottles rattle inside. It seemed our joint experience set the seal of validity on them, concluded Margaret Rutherford. The following evening it appears that Miss Rutherford and her dresser thought they caught a glimpse of John Buckstone entering the room. In a report in the Star for April 29, 1944, the actress Drusilla Willis, who was appearing in Yellow Sands, saw Buckstone's wraith backstage. The actor Victor Leslie once returned to his dressing room at the theater to find an elderly man in an old-fashioned suit declaiming Shakespeare in his armchair. Indignant, Leslie locked the door. There was only one way out, and went for the stage manager. On returning, the two men found the room empty, except for an apparently apported old account book, which mysteriously appeared on the chair where the ghost had been sitting. From time to time, Buckstone has appeared not only in a box but on stage. One Haymarket buff remembers. In 1963, when the late Michael Flanders was appearing into the review at the drop of a hat, the assistant stage manager saw a man standing behind the performer's wheelchair. Flanders was a polio victim. Thinking that it must be a stagehand who had been trapped on stage when the curtain went up, the stage manager was about to give instructions for the curtain to be lowered when the figure moved, and it was seen that it could not be a stagehand, since the figure was dressed in a long black frock coat. As the stage manager watched, very puzzled as to who the man could be, the figure suddenly vanished mid-stage. A description of the figure admirably fitted John Buckstone. Some say that the Haymarket is also haunted by David Edward Morris, a former partner manager. His materializations were commented upon by witnesses, including Frederick Harrison, who was a manager until 1926, and business manager Horace Watson. Mrs. Stuart Watson also avers that the theater is haunted by Harry Fielding, the celebrated English author of the novel Tom Jones. London Palladium, Argyle Street. On the site where the famous London Palladium now stands was the townhouse, Argyle Street, that belonged to the Dukes of Argyll. At the rear of the theater's royal circle there exists the old crimson staircase, which is said to be a remnant of the ducal house. Down the staircase from time to time comes the ghost of a crinoline lady. She has been seen by staff, audience, artists, and music hall stars. She makes no sound, not even the rustling of her gown can be heard. The ghostly woman is thought to be the spirit of Helen Campbell, a kinswoman of George John Douglas Campbell, 8th Duke of Argyll, who was a well-known Liberal Member of Parliament. She was continuously grieving for the historic wrongs wrought on fellow Scots by the powerful Campbell family. In life she threatened to haunt, when dead, Campbell property as a personal penance. Lyceum Theatre, Wellington Street. From 1871 to 1902, this theatre was the home of Sir Henry Irving's company and the scene of his and Ellen Terry's greatest triumphs. The site had been used as a theatre since 1772, but was latterly to become a dance hall. In the 1900s, the old building was demolished, leaving only the Corinthian portico. During the 1880s, a strange psychic occurrence took place at the Lyceum. A man and his wife, who occupied one of the boxes, were chatting to each other during the first interval, when the man's gaze became fastened on a woman wearing flowing silks sitting in the fourth row of the stalls, about the 12th seat along. Could he believe his eyes? Was that a man's head in the woman's lap? Yes, his wife confirmed the fact just as the lights were going down. To satisfy their curiosity, during the next interval, the man and his wife went down to the stalls to get a closer look. They couldn't get near enough, but saw that the object was now covered by a silk wrap on the woman's lap. They returned to their box, and at the end of the play they tried to intercept the woman, but missed her in the crowd. However, the face of the head remained fixed in their memories. It belonged to a person of the cavalier type, with long hair, mustache, and pointed beard. It looked pallid, dead, and as if it had just come off an execution. This grisly event passed from the man's memory until some years later, when he traveled to Yorkshire to value some old paintings at Temple Museum near Leeds. In a stockroom he found two portraits, on the wrapper of which was a label saying that they had once hung at the Lyceum Theatre. As he unwrapped the paper and looked at the paintings, the art collector had a shock, for one of the paintings was of the man whose head he had seen in the woman's lap all those years before. Making inquiries, the collector found that the two paintings were of members of the family of the Earls of Essex. One of this family was beheaded in the early days of Oliver Cromwell's rule. The Essex family had once owned the ground on which the Lyceum was built. It may be doubted that the woman in the stalls of the Lyceum was aware of the gruesome burden in her lap. It is on record, too, that a corpse-like figure used to stalk backstage during performances. Marlborough Theatre, Holloway. Long replaced, this theatre was once haunted by an irritable old actor's ghost. Grumbling to itself, the spectre would stamp near the vicinity of the manager's office, fingering its astrakhan collar. A former manager of the theatre, Billy Quest, was often told by patrons and artists that they had seen the ghost, but he never saw it himself. Every psychic researcher hopes that he can come across a unique story for his collection. One such concerns Helen Shaftesbury, a character actress who played the Marlborough during the 1896 to 1902. During the summer of 1900, Helen Shaftesbury spent a vacation with the Warrens of Layer de la Haye, Essex. At the time, she was collecting notes for a paper on the use of the picture of St. Christopher in Essex churches. At one time, most churches in the country had a picture of this saint on the north wall by the door, where all might see it as they came out of church and ask the saint's protection on their everyday travels. Miss Shaftesbury noted the St. Christopher's at Little Baddow, Canweden, Fearing, Ingatestone, Latin, Fairstead, and Ongar, and at last cycled over to see the one at St. Mary's, Layer Marney. The Layer Marney St. Christopher is hung, most unusually, at the east end of the nave and was somewhat renovated in the 1880s. Yet the honest-to-goodness face of the saint was appealing, and Miss Shaftesbury set up her small easel to take a pencil likeness of the old big-featured man with the eel twisted around one ankle to hang in her dressing room. She had almost finished her preliminary sketch of the St. Christopher picture when a rustling sound behind her attracted her attention. As she turned around, she heard a voice softly saying, "Marnie." Miss Shaftesbury listened for a moment, heard nothing more, and continued with her work. A few minutes later, the rustling sound was heard again, and the gentle voice calling, "Marnie." This time Miss Shaftesbury got up from her camp stool and looked around the church. There was nothing unusual, and no one to be seen. She was quite alone. About 10 minutes later, the exact thing happened again. Getting a little annoyed and thinking someone was playing a trick on her, the actress jumped up and said, "Who's there? What do you want?" in a loud voice and with as much authority as she could muster. There was no answer. On returning to her stool, her attention was drawn to a monument bearing the inscription, "Sir Henry, First Lord Marney." Intrigued, Miss Shaftesbury searched around the church to see if she could find any further inscriptions about the Marney family, of whom she had never heard. Finding nothing, she called at the vicarage when she had completed her picture. The vicar was out, but his wife offered her a cup of tea and an invitation to look up Sir Henry in her husband's library. As the clock on the mantelpiece ticked away, the actress began to build up a picture of the Tudor gentleman from the dusty books. Sir Henry had been the son of Sir John Marney of Layer Marney and his wife, Jane Throckmorton. Born in 1457, Sir Henry had been a privy councillor to King Henry VII in 1485 and had fought at the Battle of Stoke in 1487 and the Battle of Blackheath. In 1494, he was created a knight bachelor, and from 1509 until his death was Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. Under King Henry VIII, he held various positions, including Keeper of the Privy Seal. On April 9, 1523, the king created him Baron Marney at Richmond. Sir Henry was married twice, first to Thomasine Arundel of Cornwall, and secondly to Elizabeth Wyfold of Holloway, London. How strange, thought the actress, the very district I am playing at the moment. The distinguished man died on May 24, 1523, at his house in St. Swithin's Lane, London. His body was brought back to Layer Marney Church, where he was buried in the chancel. Miss Shaftesbury noted that this was from where she thought the mystery voice had appeared to emanate. A benefactor to his county and the builder of an almshouse, Sir Henry had ordered the erection of Layer Marney Tower at Tiptree. The edifice had been started in 1517, but was never finished. Today the building remains not a mansion, but an enormous gateway rivaling that of Thomas Cardinal Wolsey's at the Palace of Hampton Court. Layer Marney Tower, with its distinctive black bricks, has two large 8-story octagonal towers flanking two central stories, all lighted with small pointed windows. There it was in 1798 that a group of wandering players, rehearsing for a harvest festival play, had been terrified by the voice of a ghost repeating the name Marney. Sir Henry certainly had a penchant for actors. Just as she finished reading, the vicar returned, and Miss Shaftesbury told him about the mysterious voice in the church. The clergyman was silent for a while and then said, "Several of my parishioners have heard a voice in the church calling out Marney, but on most occasion it has been around the anniversary of Sir Henry's death, say at Easter or early May. Every time the voice had been heard, someone had been looking at the St. Christopher picture, just as the actress had done. This had led to its nickname Sir Henry's favorite picture." The vicar told Helen Shaftesbury that his predecessor had actually seen Sir Henry's wraith walking down the chancel away from the picture, and had met two people who had also seen and heard the ghost, but this time at Layer Marney Tower itself. Sometime around the early 1860s, two workmen had been doing some repair work in the top room of one of the towers of the building. Since the work had to be completed within a certain time limit, the workmen had taken bedrolls and camped out nearby. 3 nights they spent in a turret room at Layer Marney Tower, and each night their slumbers were interrupted by the banging of a door, as if it were being continually slammed shut. Getting up to investigate the noise, the workmen located the door that must have been slammed. They found, however, that it was heavily bolted, and the hinges and fasteners were so rusted that no one could have opened it without damaging the woodwork. On the third night, the men had been roused again, but as they approached the door, they saw the figure of a man in armor standing by the portal. Around the spectre's shoulders was swathed a cloak, and in his hand he carried a large seal. Sometime afterward, one of the men said that the figure they had seen greatly resembled the recumbent figure among the Marney tombs at Layer Marney Church. The room where the workmen were was the same as that in which the actors had heard the manifestation. Helen Shaftesbury wrote an account of the ghost in her diary, and of her conversation with the vicar. She wrote, "I heard the voice in the church clearly 3 times, within a matter of minutes. It was a deep, rather guttural voice, with a rather countrified accent. Never before this had I heard the surname Marney mentioned, nor have I ever heard of Sir Henry before." Miss Shaftesbury's diary was found among her papers on her death in 1928. For devotees of the theater ghost, the journal is particularly interesting because under the date February 17, 1901, is this fascinating entry. "Sir Henry followed me to the Marlborough. It so happened that in the early months of the year we were doing a play with knights in armor in it. Before every performance, the name Marney was heard to echo round the theater in the same accent I had heard before. Was it on the site of the theater that Sir Henry's second wife had lived, and through me he had come back from Essex to find her? A seance was held at the theater, and during the vigil the name Marney was spoken. But this time the voice said, 'Pity poor Bet.' Was it referring to Elizabeth Wyfold of Holloway? Metropolitan Music Hall, Edgewater Road." Now demolished, this vaudeville theater had a ghost that was deemed to be the spirit of a former manager who had been killed during active service in World War I. He was often seen by artists, watching the stage and the house. When the audience was sparse, the ghost dressed in a brown suit would walk up and down very agitated. New Theater, St. Martin's Lane. This theater, now the Albury Theater, was built for Sir Charles Wyndham, who died in 1919, and his wife, Mary Moore, whose son by her first marriage, Sir Bronson Albury, controlled it until his death in 1971. One day, it appears, the well-known actor Barry Jones was sitting on some backstage steps of the theater during a break in rehearsal. A rather handsome man with wavy gray hair suddenly appeared behind him. Thinking that the man wanted to pass, Jones and the actress he was talking to both stood aside. The man nodded his thanks as he passed, and crossing the stage, went towards the dressing rooms. A few minutes later, the man's appearance struck a chord in Barry Jones' memory. He went over to where the man had vanished, and finding an attendant standing by the door the man must have gone through, Jones asked if he had noticed anyone pass. The man was definite that he had seen no one. Jones and the actress were just as definite that they had seen the gray-haired man, whom Jones now remembered. It had been Sir Charles Wyndham, but Sir Charles had been dead for years. Old Royalty. A woman dressed in a white gown of Queen Anne's reign is said to have been seen at this theater before it was destroyed. W. McQueen Pope records having seen the ghost of an old lady here. Old Vic, Waterloo Road. This theater was opened on May 11, 1818, as the Royal Coburg Theater. Its name was later changed to the Royal Victoria Theater in honor of Queen Victoria. Once it was known for sensational melodrama with a rough, undermannerly audience. But it was to win fame as a Shakespearean theater, inspired by Lillian Bayless. Not surprisingly, the ghost of the Old Vic combines both the blood and thunder and Shakespearean aspects of the theater's history. From time to time, a frightful specter of a distraught woman wringing her bloodstained hands appears, reenacting the part of Lady Macbeth. Grampian Theater, Shaftesbury Avenue. In a letter to my late grandfather, Britain's best-known ghost hunter, the late Elliot O'Donnell, told of a theater mystery that had been recounted to him during a tour in 1899 by a relative of the actress concerned. The Grampian Theater is no more, but like many other small theaters, it changed its name many times during its history. This is a story as it was taken from the psychic Elliot O'Donnell's holograph letter of December 31, 1927. One evening, at about 6:30, actress Connie Burton entered the backstage area of the Grampian Theater, where she was appearing in The Brigands, and ascended the stone staircase to the dressing room she shared with several other chorus girls. As she reached the passage leading to the chorus dressing room, she saw her friend Sonia Lester standing at the door of her own dressing room. Sonia glanced at her with a troubled expression, and Connie wanted to stop and talk to her, for she knew that worries had been piling up on the other girl recently. But she was late, so she postponed the talk. As she hurried down the passage, she saw Sonia turn the handle, open the dressing room door, slip inside, and close the door behind her. Then Connie rather forgot the other girl in the bustle of getting ready to go on stage herself. Connie just managed to be on stage in time for the overture. Sonia wasn't there yet, but her entrance was not until the first scene of the second act, so Connie thought nothing of it. As the first act curtain was about to go up, another chorus girl asked if she had seen Sonia, and she answered yes. "Well, she wasn't in her room just now when I went there with a message from Mr. Clements," the girl replied. Mr. Clements was the producer. There was no time for further conversation, but Sonia did not appear backstage at any time during the first act. Shortly before the curtain rose for the second act, Clements was in the wings talking to the stage manager and anxiously waiting to speak to Sonia. There was no sign of her. "I hope nothing is the matter with her," he said to the stage manager. "I'm getting worried. I was told she was not at all well last night. Just now I sent someone to her room to inquire, but she was not there, and that's rather strange, for she should have been dressing. Very likely she was in someone else's room, the stage manager suggested. I was talking to Joe at the stage door tonight when she came in. I thought she looked rather pale, but otherwise she seemed quite her usual self. Clements grew more and more fidgety. All the other actors in that scene were either in their places on the stage or in the wings ready to go on, and still no Sonia. He gave orders for the curtain to be held until he found out what was keeping her, and sent someone to her room to find her. Still, Sonia was not there. What to do? The curtain could not be kept back much longer. The audience was already getting restless, shuffling its feet and murmuring. The producer gave up and sent for Sonia's understudy, and the show continued. But that didn't answer the question of what had happened to Sonia. Much worried now, for the girl was a favorite with him, as she was with nearly all the company, Clements instituted a search for her. She was nowhere to be found. He interviewed Joe Peel, the stage doorman, and Peel corroborated what the stage manager had told him. "I saw her, Mr. Clements," he said, "as clearly as I see you now. It was Miss Lester, right enough. She came as usual at 6:30. I was rather surprised that she didn't say something to me as she always does. She went by as if she was in a hurry, looking neither to the right nor left." "Did she look as if there was anything the matter with her?" Clements asked. The doorman shook his head. "She looked rather white and as if something was troubling her, but apart from that she seemed quite her usual self." "Did you see her leave?" The doorman thought a moment. "Now I come to think of it," he said slowly, "I didn't. Had she passed my office, I must have seen her. The door was wide open. But I am positive she never went by." Clements was puzzled. "I can't understand it," he muttered. "Where the devil can she be?" He questioned the members of the cast. Connie Burton was apparently the only one who had seen her. "I take my oath it was Sonia," she insisted. "I saw her standing in the passage outside her room, with one hand on the door handle. I was only a few feet from her. I could almost have touched her. She didn't speak, only turned her head, looked at me, and then went into her room. If I hadn't been in such a hurry, I would have spoken to her." "Did she look ill?" Clements asked. "She didn't look any too grand," Connie said, "but she hasn't for the last few days. Her eyes had been bothering her. She was going to see a specialist about them in the morning." Sonia's part in the show, being only a very minor one, she did not have a dresser. Otherwise, a dresser's testimony would have been of great importance, as would that of the girl who usually shared Sonia's room. Unfortunately, the latter was away that night with a bad cold. The call boy was of no help. He couldn't remember whether he heard anyone in the room, whether he knocked at the door or not. Sonia's presence at the theater that night rested solely on the testimony of Joe, the stage doorman, the stage manager, and Connie Burton, and all three insisted that they had seen her there. Sorely puzzled, Clements drove to Sonia's flat. Mary Lester, Sonia's sister, opened the door to him, red-eyed and pale. "I hope there's nothing the matter with your sister," he said. "Then you don't know," she cried. "I thought you must somehow have heard." A chill feeling of apprehension ran through him. "Know what?" "Sonia is dead," Mary said in a choking voice. "She died suddenly at 6:30 this evening. I ought to have let you know, but I was too upset. Her health had been bad for some time, and the worry about her eyes. She feared that she was going blind made it worse." Clements was shocked. He expressed his great distress and sympathy to Mary, and returned at once to the theater. "You must have been mistaken," he said to Connie and the man at the stage door. "You could not have seen Sonia. She died at her home at 6:30 this evening." They were unshaken, however, in their conviction that it was Sonia whom they had seen that evening at 6:30. If it was not Sonia herself, they told Clements and everyone in the theater, it must have been her ghost. This is the only recorded version of the ghost of Sonia Lester at the Grampian. Royalty Theater, Dean Street. This theater was built in 1840 by Fanny Kelly on the site of an 18th-century house, which itself was reported to have been haunted. The theatre was erected, as it said, with money supplied by the Duke of Devonshire. Ghost hunter R. Thurston Hopkins left the best version of this haunting. The specter is a gypsy girl dressed in a vivid green and scarlet silk gown, and she rattles a tambourine as she wanders through the offices, which contain some of the rooms of the Queen Anne building. It is said that she makes her way down the stairs to the vestibule and vanishes. She only walks when the orchestra is playing, and it is the music of the violin, the devil's staff, the gypsies call it, which attracts her, for her lover was a Romany soul fiddler. She is always seeking to hear the magical fire of a gypsy violin. It is said that the Romany fiddler murdered the girl and buried her in a hollow wall of the ancient house, which was afterwards incorporated in the Royalty Theatre. When the theatre was erected, the workmen discovered the girl's almost mummified body in a tomb of plaster of Paris. Another girl is associated with the theatre, that of a little old lady dressed in early Victorian costume. Most of the attendants of the royalty saw her at one time or another as a misty and gray form. She had a happy atmosphere about her, and she usually appeared as a performance was about to start. Many patrons saw her too, an old lady in ringlets, silk dress, and bonnet. Sadler's Wells Theatre, Rosebery Avenue. Besides haunting the Theatre Royal Drury Lane, the ghost of the famous clown, Joseph Grimaldi, also visits this theatre, which goes back to the 17th century. On its site in 1683, a Thomas Sadler discovered a medicinal spring and built a small music house so that people might drink the waters in pleasant surroundings. There has been a theatre here since Rustman's original of 1753. The theatre closed after a mixed career in 1903 but was reopened in 1931. It suffered war damage and now presents a year-round season of operas, ballet, and drama. Grimaldi knew the theatre well, as did his show business family, who entertained packed houses here. His ghost has been seen in one of the boxes in the dead of night, staring at the auditorium with glassy eyes. There have been occasions, too, when his face, in a clown's white pan makeup, has been seen behind people sitting in the box. St. James Theatre, King Street. Designed by Samuel Beasley and built by the singer John Braham, the St. James opened its doors to the public on December 14, 1835. Designed with a Roman facade and an interior reflecting the theater of the Palace of Versailles, it was an unlucky theater, even though one of its greatest performers, Sir George Alexander, brought it fame, and Charles Dickens wrote a Burletta, which was staged here. The theater was the home of a tactile ghost, a ghost of touch. Several people were helped on with coats and costumes while in a certain dressing room. Could this have been the ghost of some earthbound dresser? The theater was demolished in 1957. It is interesting to note that the site was once occupied by Nero's Hotel, to which Horatio Viscount Nelson returned after his victorious Battle of the Nile. The hotel was deemed haunted by the ghost of an 18th century actress who once lodged there. Theatre Royal, Angel Lane, Stratford, Atbo. Joan Littlewood's theatre workshop made this theatre famous in the 1950s. Its history, however, goes back to 1880, when it was built by Freddie Fredericks, who is thought to walk the building's dark corridor still. Those who have seen the ghost, a small, tubby fellow dressed in brown, say that he is friendly and that he comes to see that his initials FF remain in the middle of the arch spanning the stage. Theatre Royal Drury Lane. Undoubtedly the most famous of all London's haunted theatres. There have been four theatres of this name on the present site. The first was during 1663 to 1672 and it was destroyed by fire. The second was there during 1674 to 1791 and was demolished because of age and disrepair. The third was built in 1794 until 1809 and was also destroyed by fire. And the present noble building was established in 1812. Thus, Drury Lane, by virtue of its foundation and history, is an entity unique among the theaters of the world. Edmund Kean, Dan Leno, Sir Frank Benson, and thousands of other famous names have played here, and a sparkling history of hits like Rosemary, Cavalcade, Glamorous Night, Oklahoma, and Hello, Dolly. The longest run has been achieved here, however, by the ghostly man in gray. This ghost has been seen by hundreds of people during the last 200 years, yet the man who has seen it most often was the great doyen of the theater, Wes McQueen Pope. He averred that the ghost did not behave in a manner generally accepted as conventional for spooks and specters. The gray man of Drury Lane, it seems, walks only by day. He makes no noise and walks around harming no one in a gentlemanly way. He is purely a local ghost and is seen in only one part of the house and always moves in the same direction in his walk, counterclockwise. The specter comes quietly out of the wall of a room on the upper circle level, now used as a bar, walks across it, through the glass door, turns left into the upper circle, ascends the stairs, walks right around the back, down the stairs on the other side, through another door, and through the wall again in the room, also a bar, which is on the opposite side of the theater to that from which he appears. So far as can be ascertained, the ghost does not have regular days for perambulation. Sometimes he is seen frequently, sometimes months elapse. He gives no warning, neither does he dislike company. He has been seen by members of the audience when a matinee was in progress, and was not least disturbed when a bomb dropped right in the middle of his walk during World War II. Strangely enough, the ghost is a good judge of a play. He is seen most frequently during the run of a success and does not patronize flops. Consequently, a sight of him before a new production starts is considered a good omen. He revealed himself before the first night of Oklahoma, 2 days before Carousel, and 2 days before South Pacific. He ignored Noel Coward's Pacific 1860, which flopped. Most descriptions of him agree. He wears a wide, dark-colored hat on his powdered hair or wig. His long riding cloak is draped around him, covering a dress coat with ruffled sleeves. The end of his sword can be seen, and his riding boots, too. It has been even possible on some occasions to glimpse his features. A strong, well-formed face, with a good chin and clear-cut nose. All in all, the general impression is the same as when one sees figures on the stage through a gauze. No one has ever got nearer to him than 40 feet or so. There is no recorded data on who the ghost was in mortal life, but it is usually associated with a strange discovery made around 1848. In a tiny room bricked up in the thickness of the walls, those adjoining Russell Street, which are the only remaining walls of the building designed by Sir Christopher Wren, a skeleton was found with a dagger of Cromwellian pattern in its ribs. Is the ghost the wandering spirit of a man murdered in the 17th century in Drury Lane who was quietly bricked up? The ghost does appear from the wall adjoining where the skeleton was found. The bones, by the way, were buried in a little cemetery at the corner of Russell Street and Drury Lane, the cemetery mentioned by Dickens in Bleak House as the place where Lady Dedlock died. Some people, like American actress Betty Jo Jones, who appeared in Oklahoma, have seen the ghost of the great Don Joseph Grimaldi on stage. Seen in front of the pit, sometimes as a tall, emaciated, hatchet-faced ghost, whose description fits quick-tempered Irish actor Charles Macklin. In a quarrel over a wig, Macklin killed fellow actor Thomas Hallam in 1735 in the green room. Comedian Stanley Lupino, father of screen actress Ida Lupino, also averred that he saw and spoke to the ghost of the famous Dan Leno in 1923. Lupino said that he had decided to sleep in his dressing room after a show. It was a very wet and stormy night, and he had just dozed off when he had a feeling that he was not alone. He saw a shadowy form moving across the room, and a few minutes later he recognized the materialized face of Dan Leno. Lupino's wife saw the ghost in the same room the next day and promptly fainted. Two ladies occupying gangway seats in the block of the dress circle once saw Charles Kean, the actor-manager son of the great actor Edmund Kean, sitting watching a performance. They later recognized him from a photograph. According to actor Tony Britton, one of the cast of the hit musical No, no, Nanette. There is yet another phantom that haunts the old playhouse with a vengeance. Mr. Britton relates that the wardrobe mistress and her assistant were walking along a corridor, the upstairs part of the theater, when a no-smoking sign whistled over their heads. They turned around, but no one was in sight. The same evening, Mr. Britton was attacked by the ghost in his dressing room during the intermission. His chair was pulled from under him, and he only saved himself from falling by holding on to a nearby wardrobe. Later that night, transistor radios were mysteriously switched on and off in the dressing room of other members of the cast.